Hello and welcome back to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This was episode 138 and we had Kenne and Tristan on and we were talking about cybersecurity and the PCI DSS. And how do you think it went, guys? Kenne, a good session?
Yeah, it was actually a very good session. It was a blast.
A blast.
Talking about the PCI DSS is one of the one thing that I love doing, right? So, yeah. I enjoyed the session.
That was good. And you ended up a bit of a bystander, Tristan. You couldn't really get a word in edgeways.
All right. No, it was really interesting, though. I think it's such an interesting dynamic, seeing it from a different perspective, like how to, you know, protect to certain particular information. So it was great just to have Kenne on and really have a, you know, insightful ear into how to comply with PCI DSS.
Yeah, I mean, we probably only scratched the surface. We didn't really talk. I mean, there's probably a lot of commonality we could have talked about. We could have talked about, you know, supply chain management and various other kind of things that are common across GDPR and PCI. But yeah, I think we probably did a reasonable job of explaining about the version 4 and some of the changes. I mean, you particularly like talking about the customized approach, didn't you, Kenne?
Yeah, there's a whole lot that we could have talked about, but not because of the time. Yeah, but this being the first time, hopefully there'll be more time.
Yeah, very good. And we did a little bit of news, and we didn't do much news, did we? Most of that, again, was security focused, you know, the Electoral Commission failing Cyber Essentials, some talked about the patching problems and hacks resulting from patching problems. But I mean, the kind of common thread appears to be, which I think we've been talking about for years, is the human element. You know, as soon as you introduce humans to either applying patches or setting strong passwords or complying with policies, then the wheels start to come off sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, I can completely agree. I mean, are you suggesting more AI, Phil?
More AI. I think AI is you know, very good. It's going to change a lot. I think it's going to change the world a lot. And, you know, I don't see that you can avoid it. It's going in a particular direction, you know, and it's going to carry on, I think. We'll see. You have to talk about it next week, maybe.
Yeah.
So, yes, this session was all about the PCI DSS and cybersecurity. We had Kenne on, who's a qualified security assessor for the PCI DSS, got a great background in cybersecurity. So that was an absolute pleasure having you on the session, Kenne. And without further ado, we'll just let you dive in and have a listen and see what you think.
Thank you so much, Phil. Thank you, Tristan, for having me.
No worries. Thanks, everyone.
Then please let us know afterwards. So yes, how's your week been, Kenne? You've been busy with stuff, have you?
Yeah, I've had some mails to attend to, some queries from clients which I've addressed and responded, some documentation to look at. Yeah,
it's a busy
check, and
anyway,
the week has been fantastic.
That's good to know that it's had a good week. What have you been up to, Tris?
Yeah, we've just been dealing with like a lot of cases, a lot of Roper work. I can't take you seriously, Phil.
Should I turn the camera off?
Nah.
I don't see a thing. Right, carry on.
A lot of kind of like Roper work and some DPIAs that we've had through this week.
Right.
And what about yourself? Have you been busy?
Yeah, I've been in the office 3 days, which has been brilliant to get in amongst people again. You know, we're trying to get a drive to get, you know, more office. I mean, you just miss such a lot by being. I love being, and you're just sparking off people all the time. It's really good being back in the office. We had a meeting on, you know, Tuesday and you know, some various other meetings. So the trouble with me getting in the office is I live 70 miles away from the office. It takes me an hour and a half to get there and an hour and a half to get back. So I end up having short days, and I come back, you know, and I haven't read my emails by the time I get home, and then I've not read my emails by the time I set off, get a warning, and it goes on like that. So I've had yesterday was mostly catching up with hundreds of emails.
Wow.
But there you go, can't complain. So today we're going to talk about, thank you, Miles, for the privacy notice. Today we're going to be talking about cybersecurity in the main, and we're going to be talking about the payment card industry, data security standard, maybe some ISO 27001, maybe some cyber essentials, maybe a bit about cyber maturity assessment, So Kenny, I'm going to ask you to kind of introduce yourself and tell us what you've been doing in your career shortly. But and kind of this is to everybody who's here on the live session. You know, Kenny is a cybersecurity consultant, got a great background in cybersecurity. So if you've got any questions about security, and today is the session to kind of to get those out. So we've got quite a bit in the news to talk about as well, so I think it'll be quite a busy session. But Kenny, do you want to just, because I think this is your first time on the podcast, is it?
Yeah, it's actually my first time. Yeah, so hi everyone. My name is Kenny Chiobilo, but you can call me Kenny. All right, so I'm currently working with data protection people. I'm the cyber security consultant and now part of the QSA in data protection people. Yeah.
So what's and your back, have you worked in finance before, banking? I can't remember exactly the detail of where you've worked, which sectors.
Okay, yeah, I had a background in electronic engineering anyway, but my first job in cyber security was with a cyber security firm. All right, so I've always been in a consulting firm anyway, so be consulting for different organizations like financial institutions, telecommunications, and co. Yeah, but I did a few things for like a full staff in financial institution, but wasn't that long anyway, but I've done much of a consulting for right. them then, yeah.
And how did you get into cybersecurity, and why did you get into cybersecurity?
Okay, as I said, I had a background in electronic engineering, right? So we touched base on some of the cybersecurity stuff. And my first job was with a cybersecurity firm. So I was with their governance, risk, and compliance. And that actually, you know, led my interest in cybersecurity space. Yeah, there might be a list, let me say, cybersecurity is broad, but I kind of focus in the area of the compliance. So I've done a lot of job in consulting area of ISO 27001, PCI DSS, ISO 27701, ISO 22301. So I've implemented that, carry out a gap analysis for them for over the years. I've actually been in cybersecurity space for like over 5 to 6 years now. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. So, yeah. We've got quite a bit in the news has been happening. There's been a couple of breaches. Yeah. You know, with schools this week. There's been two schools, I think, being locked out of their systems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you been up on the news, Tris? Have you seen what's been happening in the news?
Yeah. I have seen a lot about the breaches and whatnot, but I want to kind of quickly talk about something that happened yesterday.
Oh,
so
right, yes.
The French MP, I'm going to butcher his name, but Philippe Latamobi, he's actually sent a letter to the court of the European Court of Justice to ask them to pull back or, you know, see the EU-US framework to be invalid. And it's kind of on two different grounds. It's quite interesting.
Right.
The first
quick off the mark, wouldn't he?
Yeah, no, the way that he's kind of taken the stance is that he's looking at this as a civilian of the French people. He issued a kind of an open statement yesterday, and the two kind of points. The first point is a bit more, political, but effectively, the European Parliament did have some concerns, and the commission never, what he claims, that the commission never really took any of those concerns on, and that there was no ability for the national courts to discuss about these, you know, these areas of concerns and these frameworks. And the second point is that there seems to be a bit of a secrecy in how the US is actually going to achieve compliance, especially with their kind of new court. And what he said is that without these being published, we don't know if it's going to be compliant or not, or how they're going to achieve being compliant. So it was a really kind of a interesting three-page letter, which I've got it as a PDF. It might be worth, if people want it, we could possibly send it out. But it could be a very quick turnover with the EU and the US framework.
Yeah, well, that might be interesting for how the UK extension works as well. I mean, I was reading that there's already some firms three firms, and GoDaddy, Avature, and Garmin have all have all signed up to the UK extension already, despite it not actually kind of being there. But that would just be really interesting to see what happens there if the EU strikes it down again. You know, what'll happen in the UK? Be interesting, won't it?
I feel like we're kind of bystanders in this. We're just kind of watching this being kind of unfolded, because you know we know Shrooms is going to challenge it. We've seen now a second second contender is now has challenged it. It's not going to and it will be interesting to see kind of what happens. And I think, you know, does the commission trump the parliament in terms of Europe? And there could be some political ramifications beyond that of GDPR from it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds.
Mm.
Now, the thing I think my story of the week was that
sorry, that just caught jump right in.
No, that's absolutely great. You know, but my story of the week, again, I don't know if anybody's seen this, is quite widely reported, so I'm sure people have. But Mozilla, you know, the people who make Firefox browser, they do lots of surveys about products, and they kind of list those that are poor in terms of their privacy arrangements. But they've had a look at car brands, 25 different car brands, and it's staggering when you read the report, the kind of information that the car brands are collecting. So the stories you're reading is privacy nightmare on wheels. There's some kind of clever journalistic pun going on. But you know, they're saying that Tesla is the worst. So 84% of all the car brands are admitting to kind of sharing personal data with service providers, data brokers, and a variety of other undisclosed businesses. And they're saying Tesla and Nissan are actually the worst, and you know, some of the car brands are better than others, but they're all pretty poor. And what they've found is, and I'm not sure how they've undertaken this research. So I've got the research paper open my desktop and I'm going to read it, because I'm actually interested in how they've approached this. But Mozilla is kind of warning that manufacturers may collect and commercially exploit much more than location history and driving habits, in-car browsing histories and music preferences. What they've got is some quite deep personal data, such as sexual activity, immigration status, race, facial expressions, weight, health, and even genetic information. Now, how on earth they're collecting that kind of information or in creating that kind of information, I don't know. But they're saying that they're using sensors and microphones and cameras and phones and other devices that people plug into their cars. This is where they're collecting this data from. Worrying, really. You know, plug something in to charge it up, and maybe it's getting its data sucked out of it.
So I believe, I think a couple of months ago, the German courts were looking into this with Tesla, because I don't have the article up. I just recall this happening. I think it was a whistleblow from Tesla's own employees saying that effectively when the cars kind of go in like standby, they are recording all the information around
them.
And, you know, it really kind of brings into this whole necessity aspect. And more importantly, these engineers could access this. And there was no, from what I'm recalling anyway, there was no kind of security, or there was no kind of protocol. Any engineer could effectively access this.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I haven't checked this out, but according to this Which report, Nissan includes sexual activity in the data it collects in its privacy notice, and Kia includes information about your sex life. I mean, I do need to go and check this out, because, I mean, why? I mean, it's absolutely beggar's belief, doesn't it? So, I mean, this story is like, wow. And then related. Sorry, Kenny. You know what we're like. You probably don't know what we're like on this. We just rabbit on. So you must dive in if you've got something you want to say, and we will stop. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, for that car part, I'm looking at the news. But for me, what I just looked at today is I just saw that there was so many hacks this week, and even last period, there were a lot of reported hacks. I noted some that happened in a school in Kent. Yeah, so the school principal reported of a cyber attack. Actually, it's not a data protection, but it is on a cyber attack. So their system were actually hacked. It was hit, and you know, it was more like a ransomware attack, right? So all of their data was encrypted, and though the school did not report that that the hackers have demanded for ransom, well, the scenario that they portrayed is more like a ransomware attack. They also this morning also noted a notice from BBC, right? A school in I think North London, they had to shut down because they had to shut down because of a ransomware attack. And then also the ransomware attack, it was actually kind of massive anyway for this month and last. Even PCI SSC had to release a bulletin, right, on a phishing attack. Somebody's trying to pretend to be from the council, and they sent out a phishing email to all the merchants. I think I can pull up the article. Yeah, I shared it by the email.
Yes, I saw it earlier.
They had to send out a bulletin to all the merchants, trying to notify them that, look, this email is not from the council. Please don't submit any of your sensitive business information. So then that was actually a very big one, because these attackers were focusing on getting sensitive information from the merchants, you know, like the people that processes or transmit cardholder data. Yeah, apparently trying to see a way to, you know, to compromise their system. So the PCI had to release a bulletin on that.
All right, yeah. So that's possibly a bit embarrassing for them.
Yeah.
There's a couple of other breaches, which kind of is all, you know, these cyber type of approach, you know, breaches. I mean, the other things in privacy, like I've read also another article about smart home devices that are collecting masses of personal data, like washing machines you need to put your date of birth into and a name and an email address. And, you know,
are you talking about the witch article that came out
yes,
the other day?
Yeah.
Have you seen, I know I'm kind of jumping the gun, but the ICO has actually released a statement in response to that.
Oh, I haven't seen that. What do they say?
So I'm just going to read this. ICO statement in response to the witch report on smart devices harvesting data. Effectively what it says is, people should be able to enjoy the benefits of using their connected devices without having excessive amounts of their personal data gathered. This simply isn't a price we expect to pay. To maintain trust in these products, companies must be transparent about the data they collect and how they will use it, and to ensure that the data is not used or shared in ways that people would not expect. The ICO is developing guidance on data protection and Internet of Things devices, and will act where we don't see the rules being followed. But there's no mention in that statement. I'll copy and paste the statement into the chat, so if people want to have a look at it, they can. But there's no mention really about necessity.
And legitimate interest. Well, the witch article is referring to, you know, how does this stack up on legitimate interest, which is, you know, it's quite interesting. I might have read that ICO response, actually. Remember that bit about, we've already paid a high price for these products. You know, this is not, somebody commented on that, I think. It might have been the Witch article, I don't know. So, yeah, that's you just popped that in the chat, have you? Yeah. Christopher saying that the Guardian article about the cars harvesting the data says there's lots of connected services as well. And I've got about five. I mean, Top Gear reported on this. Who else has reported on it? The Register, Yahoo, the Mozilla Foundation themselves. So it's been widely reported, and everyone's got slightly different information. You kind of had to piece it together. So, yeah, it's kind of everything that you're connecting up in your car that seems to be fair game for obtaining data from. But I mean, in the news, the hacks that have been on. So I'm interested in this one, right? The Electoral Commission apparently failed the Cyber Essentials assessment just before it was hacked. It's apparently still not actually managed to pass the Cyber Essentials. I'm interested, Kenny, because you've obviously got some good experience with Cyber Essentials. And it was things like 200 laptops running obsolete and potentially insecure software, old phones no longer supported being used by the organization. And I'm interested in your perspective on this from a Cyber Essentials point of view, because you obviously went through a lot of aggravation.
It's actually a very critical requirement for Cyber Essentials, right? And not just the Cyber Essentials, but also PCI DSS that you come into, right? Because there's a high risk there. And then having a system or having a software that is running unsecured or unpatched software is actually a very high risk, really. So for the organization itself, having to undergo a Cyber Essential and then find this gap and not remediating it and waiting for them to get hit, you know, this is just something that you actually know your risk and you just choose not to address it. It's a big one. And one thing that most of these standards actually kind of from, you have to actually maintain a secure system, not just your laptop alone, but also your mobile devices. For every device that you use to access the company's software that holds sensitive information, it should actually be maintained, ensure that your own is secure and updated.
But is that an overly onerous job? You know, I don't know how many people the Electoral Commission employs, but you know, if you've got 200 laptops out there that are obsolete, they've probably got hundreds that are not obsolete. You know, how easy is it?
There are softwares actually that that most organizations use to scan. There's all these endpoint solutions that you can use to scan your network to actually see the devices that are running outdated softwares. So with that, you'll be able to actually know this, you know, where your risk lies. And there are also other softwares which you can use to push out your patches. Although it's not an easy stuff, because I even remember when we were doing ours, working with the service provider, we were pushing patches like every Thursdays just to ensure that all the systems were updated and up to date. Yeah. And then for mobile devices, for iPhone releases patches like every time, right? So just for you to be up to date and see where you are on your mobile device. So for all the users that uses their mobile device to access the company's file, it's just a policy that the company will need to develop, like, you know, bring your own device policy and ensure that this policy is actually being enforced, right? Because some people might be using outdated operating system on their phone, like, for quite some time. And if you don't really enforce this, they won't really do it.
Yeah, just introducing vulnerabilities. So it's about being organized, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah. And having policy.
Yeah, having systems. But there's quite a lot of, I mean, there's increasingly more software that's coming out. It's increasingly clever, isn't it? Trying to help people manage these, you know, these things like patches and operating systems. But when we did our Cyber Essentials last, then I remember my Android operating system was one version too old. So you are relying on users to keep their systems up to date, aren't you? If you allow people to use their own devices, yeah.
While I was at Middlesex, when we were getting Cyber Essentials, we found actually that the actual technical measures weren't too difficult to implement, but it's getting that buy-in from everyone and trying to get kind of a company-wide or organizational-wide acceptance of what the changes have to be, and then possibly managing that scope of what's going to fall in scope of your Cyber Essentials.
You can go on, Phil.
Oh, I was just going to say, how many people were employed at Middlesex? I mean, there's thousands in universities, aren't there?
Yeah.
So it's a big, big job, isn't it?
5,000.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say that the people risk is one aspect of a risk that every organization we need to look into. People risk is actually very high, not just
the highest,
and then trying to follow it. It's very high. It's very high, really. Because most attack, if you notice, that it's always start from people. Mm. Not just having a secure system, but also if you look at the phishing attack, I think there's a school too in Connecticut. Yeah, it was reported a business email compromise that the school lost over $6 million, right? From business email compromise. So people risk is actually very high. It's very high.
Yeah, I've said this for years. Even like apparent systems risks, like out of date operating systems on phones, for instance. Well, that's because people have been the weak link. People have not updated them. Another hack attack I clocked this week as well was a company that produces high security fencing for the Ministry of Defence and the UK's military. They were hacked as well. Their database got attacked, and that was because they were apparently because they were running a Windows 7 device. Yeah.
outdated Windows. Out of life. The end of life. It's already reached its end of life. I think that was last 2 years or last 3 years.
Yeah. Windows 7. Yeah, so you'd say, well, oh, all right, well, why are they running Windows 7 devices? Well,
again, come back to
human decision making, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you can't avoid it. You know, our sailing club, we have when we're racing, you know, we have a race management system, and all it does is it manages lights and flags and horns. So, you know, you set the race up, you set the different types of boats that are participating in the race, and each boat's got its own handicap. And so when we all start, you know, you go around the race circuit, and the race will last for like an hour. And then, you know, when you cross the line, basically an operator clicks a mouse and it records the time that particular boat crossed the finish line. And then the system kind of calculate the handicap and rank everybody accordingly. So that's all the system does, but it runs on XP. So the call went out. The computer seems to have died. Has anybody got an old XP system? Well, I have. I've still got my PCW8256 from the 80s in my loft. I've got every computer I've ever owned in my loft. So I did have an XP computer. But sometimes, you know, we're finding people using systems, legacy systems. But in a business context, it's, you know, it's tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, just as you mentioned, you know, Windows Server 12, Microsoft Windows 12 is coming to end of life in October. So it's actually part of things that we as the QSA or the assessors might actually see on site from the beginning of October, November, December. You might see a whole lot of servers that are running that Windows 12. Because first, it's not that a straightforward transition. The migration for an organization that have a lot of servers to migrate from the Windows Server 12 to the latest Windows might take a lot of time to do that. So we might actually see a whole lot of Windows, a whole lot of systems or servers that are running this Windows Server 12.
I think we should probably talk about PCIDSS. And if anybody's got any questions they want to ask, you know, about the PCIDSS, then fire away, because both Kenny and I are qualified security assessors for the standard. So in theory, we know it inside out. But we've got that change coming through, Kenny, haven't we? So version 3.1.2 to version 4, you know, there's quite a lot of changes that people have got to get their heads around. What's your thoughts on it? Sorry, I keep interrupting, not letting you talk. There you go. I've stopped now.
Right. So the PCIDSS version 4, of course, is out. It was released in March 2022. An organization or the entities that process or stores or transmit or could impact the security of cardholder data have a transition period, you know, to 2024 to actually transition to PCIDSS version 4. In March 2024, I think that's when the version 3.2.1 will be retired, right? So the only native version from March 2024 will now be the version 4 standard. There's a whole lot of changes anyway, or should I say an addition to the new version, right? Yeah. But the most interesting part of it for me, which I've been looking at, is the customized approach. What about yours?
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I'm really keen to. I hope some of our customers ask us to help them with the customized approach. So, again, I don't know if anybody. Hopefully, people are aware the PCIDSS is the payment card industry's data security standard, and it's been around since I'd thought about 2006, probably 2007, and it's an international standard across the world. If you take any payments using credit cards or debit cards from five major brands like Amex or Visa or MasterCard and Japanese Credit Bank and Diners Card, I think are the five, then you must comply with the PCIDSS. It's a set of requirements, a set of rules, you know, it's a standard. It's not law, it's a standard, and it's a contractual obligation that all merchants who are taking these card payments have with their banks. So if you don't comply with the PCIDSS, you're in breach of contract, you get fined, they can stop you processing credit cards and so on and so forth. So I was just wondering whether you think that it's clear cut or more clear cut than the GDPR. I mean, the GDPR to me, I like, because it's flexible and it's woolly, particularly around security. I got the impression, first of all, when I was working with the PCIDSS, which I started working with in 2008 with Everton Football Club, but I thought it was really nicely defined and clear cut and very prescriptive. But the more I've worked with it, the less I am inclined to take that stance. I think that is also quite open to interpretation, Ken. I don't know, you know, whether you feel the same.
Okay, you mean the alliance of PCI to GDPR?
No. I mean, GDPR, PCI DSS is a set of requirements. They're quite prescriptive.
Yeah,
but
sure.
But there's still wiggle room. There's still situations where we debate. We say, well, you know, not sure what this means. You know, not sure how to apply this. It's still not absolutely prescribed, I don't think.
The good thing about version 4 is that it gives the flexibility anyway for an organization to adopt their own methodology. Hello?
No, carry on.
So as I say, that he gave the flexibility for an organization to actually adopt their own methodology, as long as the mechanism that they have adopted, you know, is meeting the intent or the objective of that requirement. But version 3.2.1 was a lot prescriptive. Yeah, you are actually very much right, because sometimes we're looking at the requirements, we're like, okay, for... So where should this really, you know, go to? I know, but I kind of like the requirement as well, compared to other international standards. I've actually implemented others and really, you know.
So we go to organizations. So we have a look. It takes a minimum of 5 or 6 days to do an assessment visit, doesn't it? I mean, when we're doing large multiple retailers, we have to look at a sample of everything, a sample of the stores, a sample of the teams and the people, sample of all the different types of equipment. So there might be 25 stores that we're going around visiting, you know, just to check that each store is consistent and compliant. But I've lost my thread. What was I talking about? Oh yeah, and we sometimes have debates about, you know, what is your card holder data environment? What are the systems and the processes and the people and the technologies that are processing card holder data or can impact security of the processing of card holder data? And very often we get, you know, the merchants or the service providers saying, oh, no, that's all totally out of scope. And we say, why is it out of scope? It looks like it's in scope to us.
Yeah.
And it's up to the merchants to determine their own
scope
and for us to test it and to seek validation that the merchant's done a good job of it.
Yeah, there's something I always say to my clients when I was consulting. I used to say that you just follow the card, as in you should follow wherever the card is going. That is how to determine your scope, because, you know, at the point of entering, at the point of capturing the cards, okay, now where does the card data now go to? So just follow that flow, you'll be able to determine your scope. Because scope validation is one thing that is actually very, very hard for, you know, for merchants and service providers. Yeah, they always miss out on something. You can actually, you know, go to assess an organization and they've given a network diagram, giving you their card flow diagram. The point where you start reviewing, you might now actually see one of these systems that just kept one side. And when you check that system in the center, you notice that the system might actually hold some card information and they would kind of inform and they can explain that the system was actually used in turn and so probably the legacy system that had been abandoned. But that system actually holds card data, so it should be in scope. Or, you know, if it's no longer in use, then it should discard or card holder data, you know, that is maintaining that system and remove it. So most of the time, it's always difficult to validate the scope, but with the assistance of the QSAs, you know, with the thorough job that they would do, also have to validate the scope too for most.
So Martin's asked a really good question. So does an organization need? If I don't know if you can see the chat, Kenny, but
yeah, I can. I'm just opening that now. Okay, does an organization need a qualified PCI DSS version 4% to gain? Well,
probably quite important. Let's talk about the levels first. So if you're processing, and correct me if I get this slightly wrong, Kenny, fewer than 20,000 transactions a year, then you have to comply with the PCI DSS, but you don't necessarily have to attest to your compliance. So basically, everyone has to comply with it, and there is an assumption that you're compliant. But every year, all the merchants and service providers that are caught by the PCI DSS have to fill in a form and attest to their compliance, an attestation of compliance, or an AOC, as we call it in the trade. But if you've got processing fewer than 20,000 transactions, it seems to be optional, but best practice to submit an AOC to your bank. Basically, that's what you'd be doing, yeah. So that's a level 4 merchant. If you're a level 3 merchant, you're processing less than, is it 1 million transactions?
Yeah, 1 million transactions. I think, yeah, 20,000 to 1 million, yeah. But then again, different card brands have their levels, right? So looking at level one, for American Express is 2.5 million, you know, and above, and JCB is from 1 million and above. So, you know.
Yeah. So they are a bit flexible. But basically, if you're a level one merchant, which is you know, doing millions of transactions a year, then you have to have a qualified security assessor come on site once a year and do a thorough assessment. And we're a qualified security assessment company, and there's only a few in the UK, and Kenny and I are both qualified security assessors. So if you're a level one merchant, you have to have that external assessment. If you're anything less than that, then you can basically self-assess. You fill in a self-assessment questionnaire, and you know, at the bottom of that is an attestation of compliance. You know, you tick all the boxes. This is what we're a bit blasé about this, because we think that people doing SAQs generally aren't doing them right. In our experience, we'll come on to that in a minute, Kenny. But they tick the boxes, they sign it off, they send it to the bank, and that's it for another year. Tick box exercise, it appears to us. But you don't have to have a qualified person inside your business. So we're qualified security assessors. You can also have an internal security assessor, an ISA, and they're qualified to do internal assessments and assessments as well. So you don't have to have anybody internally to be compliant. You know, with the PCI, it's not like a DPO. There's no requirement to have somebody in house. There are a bunch of exams, and we have to take an annual test. Which I think they should require this for DPOs as well. So Kenny and I have got to do an annual test, which is against the clock. You know, and it's actually quite tough. It's very technical. I keep pushing my own back. I've got to do like a day's swatting up and revision, and then this test for 90 minutes. So there are exams to do to become a QSA and to remain a QSA, but there's no requirement to have somebody internally. I don't know if that answers that question, but the way that people are testing compliance is you've been working with a client to help them look at their SAQs, haven't you?
Yes, I have. So for merchants level 2, level 3, then level 4, actually, they are required to fill in a self-assessment questionnaire, except if the payment brand now mandates them to, you know, to go for a rock. Probably there was a breach, then they're not required to actually go, for the actual PCI DSS assessment, which will require the invitation of a QSA. Yeah, so I've been working with some clients for self-assessment questionnaire, you know, reviewing their self-assessment questionnaire, validating what they've done and all. So it's just a straightforward document anyway. But the version 4 will be different, really. The version 4 actually have, just like Rock, you have to actually state what you tested, what you checked. You know, you should be able to put in an evidence of what you checked. So it won't be that seamless as it was in 3.1.
So let me just interrupt to explain that a ROC is a report on compliance. So when we do an assessment visit, Kenny and I have got to write, it's a template, it's a 453-page document under level 4, and under version 4. And we have to fill one of these in. We have to, it says, right, this is the requirement, this is the objectives of the requirement, and then we have to write in this report what we did to test the organization met that requirement, who we interviewed, what documentation we saw, what testing we performed, and objective evidence of what testing we performed on which sample set. So it's really really detailed, and I like that about it. I mean, it takes 2 days to fill in one of these blooming reports, but it is good, isn't it? It's rigorous.
Yeah, it is, actually, because actually, you know, you have to go through each of the requirements. You cannot miss out any, because Each of these requirements requires you to put up an evidence. So during your assessment, if you miss out any requirements, you need to actually go back to get that evidence done. ROC is very big. He's one of the nightmare for QSAs
to document. But the self-assessment questionnaires, that you don't. I mean, again, you've been working with this customer, and they've been getting self-assessment questionnaires from their customers, and they've ticked a box to say we're compliant with that requirement. But we're saying, well, how? You know, what have you done to test that? You know, and even our clients filling in SAQs and saying to us, can you validate our SAQ's been completed? And you're there saying, well, what did you do to test this requirement? And often they've done nothing, in my opinion. You know, they haven't done enough to test. Or rigorously enough, I've tested one, but that's not a representative sample. You know, we'd have to test 15 if we were doing a rock. It's just see that aspect of it to me seems like a weak link in the DSS to most.
Yeah, it is for version 3.2.1. As I say, they revised it in version 4, so it shouldn't be that seamless anymore. So they actually have to actually document what they've tested in the version 4.
That would be a vast improvement, I think.
Yeah, they actually made a whole lot of improvements. Even in SAQA, SAQA. That is, SAQA is for merchants that have outsourced all their payment platform to third-party service providers. So SAQA is the simplest of the self-assessment questionnaires to fill. So before, the requirements are just requirement 2, 6, 8, 9, and then 12. But now they've included the part of the external vulnerability scan, which is ASV. All right, so they've added that to the requirements, and then also one requirement on requirement 6. You know, they've actually included that, and that for me is a good addition, really, because for an organization that has a Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So for me, that is a good addition, really, because for an organization that has an e-commerce site, right, and they don't really do a vulnerability scan to even identify whether there's any missing patches or there's any vulnerabilities on this e-commerce site, they were fully depending on third-party service provider. But there can be a vulnerability there in a situation where the redirection link or there's a vulnerability in their e-commerce site. An attacker can actually redirect the customers instead of going to the actual payment site, so to a different site. So the addition of the vulnerability scanning for SAQA is a good addition.
Need to explain again, wind a little bit back. So the PCIDSS has got 12 main requirements. That's broken down into sub requirements, and basically, depending on how you're taking, we call them the channels of payment. So imagine e-commerce, your website is a payment channel, a mobile app might be a payment channel, a shop with actually, you know, face to face, we would call that bricks and mortar, a shop with a till and a chip and pin machine is a different type of payment channel. A contact center where you're taking payments over the phone, a different type of channel. And each of those different channels has got a different risk profile according to the PCIDSS. Yeah. So, you know, the physical, to put it in simple terms, a physical environment, a bricks and mortar environment with a chip and pin machine, you know, skimming is something that could happen. People can put a skimming device onto a chip and pin machine and it can scrape all the data off that's going through it. You can't do that technique on an e-commerce site. You've got different attack vectors on e-commerce, haven't you? So, you know, as you're quite right, they say redirect to the payment gateway. If you intercepted that piece of code that's redirecting the shopping basket to the payment gateway and transferred it to a different payment gateway, your own, which does happen, has happened, MagCart attacks are called, aren't they? Then that's a different vulnerability. Same with a contact center. You know, a contact center has got a different risk profile. So What's happened is that the Payment Council, the PCI Security Council, has got different types of self-assessment questionnaires depending on the payment channel that you're using. So if you've got an e-commerce site, a website, you fill in SAQA, self-assessment questionnaire A. If you're doing face-to-face transactions, then you would have to complete an SAQ, self-assessment questionnaire C. And they've got different numbers of the requirements in there, because if you're not storing cardholder data, you don't need to encrypt it. Whereas if you are storing cardholder data, you do need to encrypt it. So that's how those SAQs work. Sorry to interrupt.
No, sure.
Just in case people didn't kind of clock that kind of. Yeah. We're just assuming everyone knows all about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Assumption. Okay. Yeah. So the PCIDSS version 4 is actually a total revamp. Really, there's a whole lot of changes in the PCIDSS version 4. Right. As I mentioned before, that my, as in the key one for me is the customized approach. Really, is the big one. You know.
So that let's talk about a little bit about that. So I'm just going to highlight one kind of small example before we go into that. So bear that one, keep that in your mind. So one of the new requirements for one of the tricks here is to make sure that you're de-scoping your cardholder data environment. So, you know, if you're not storing cardholder data and you're contracting out all of your processing activities to PCI accredited service providers, then your risk profile is lower, your scope is of your cardholder data environment is much lower, your compliance burden is much lower, and it becomes pretty straightforward, doesn't it? So a lot of our customers are, when I worked at Everton, we stored cardholder data. It wasn't encrypted. You know, we were on an SAQD, which is every single requirement.
Every single requirement.
And we spent a couple of years de-scoping our environment, you know, encrypting the data, not storing the cardholder data, using tokens. And we ended up, you know, reducing our compliance burden hugely. But one of the changes, which I'm hoping people have clocked to are running e-commerce sites, is that you have to, under version 4, have effectively a list of approved scripts that are running on your page. So you've got your web page built, you know, it's got all the HTML or whatever it is, and it's got JavaScript snippets doing things like Google Tag Manager and whatever else it's doing. Then you have to make sure you've got a library of those and that they're authenticated, and that you've got a way of checking that all of those scripts haven't been hijacked. Again, this is something brand new, and there are tools out there to do it. But again, I'm hoping that the SAQ, people filling SAQs have clocked this and are already making moves to put in place, you know, mitigation and controls. Because, you know, if we're coming out to do a verification of an SAQ, we're going to be saying, well, where's the evidence that you've got these tools in place? We've got to actually look at them. I mean, we've got to look at the traffic going through. I mean, to check it's encrypted properly. I mean, it's really detailed stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry, you were going on to say that about the customized approach. So.
Yeah, so that's just one of the change. Anyway, there's a whole lot of changes in the PCIDSS version 4, the renumbering, the addition. Yeah, but I'm just saying that the customized approach is one big addition anyway for the organization, because I've actually been in the field, and most of the time, these entities might have a different ways that they could have met the requirements. But because the PCIDSS version 3.2.1 was prescriptive, they've actually given you the defined approach, you know, how to implement it and also even how to test it. So, you know, it was actually kind of this customized approach is a big one, and you know, for both the entities and for we the QSAs. For we the QSAs, I would say it's gonna be a tough one, really, because you know, going to audit an organization that have utilized, you know, the customized approach for almost all the requirements, it's taking a lot of time thinking about how to drive out, say, the testing procedures to understand, you know, to even understand the control that implemented, and also to check if it's meeting up the intent of the requirements. It's actually going to be a big one for, you know, for the assessors.
So, for example, you might have a better example than me, but the requirement to have passwords on systems is one of the PCIDSS requirements. And currently, you've got to have a password of at least, is it 7 characters? It is 7 characters, isn't it? Alphanumeric mixed.
Yeah.
So pretty low standard. So that's being increased. Is it 12 characters?
Yeah, 12 characters. Yeah. And 10 8 for legacy systems.
Yeah. So that's a requirement. But if you've gone beyond that, you know, if you're not using passwords, you're using biometrics or something, then technically you're not complying with the PCIDSS. So under the version 4, you're basically saying, well, the intent of the controller to ensure that systems are secure, the minimum requirements, you know, prescribed approach is you have to have passwords on systems that are minimum 12 characters. Is it changed, you know, within 90 days? We can't remember the last 5, etc.
Yeah, change every 90 days.
Yeah. So what version 4 allows is for an entity to say, actually, we're not doing that. You know, we're going to do biometric thumbprints or palm prints, whatever, as our kind of authentication mechanism. And what they'll have to do is use a customized control approach. We're using a customized control, we're using biometrics. We're going to meet the intent of the requirement because it's about securing systems. And this is what we're going to do. Now, they have to write that control. They have to write their testing for the control. They've got to write, you know, a risk assessment for that control to make sure it does meet the requirements, and they've got to keep it under review. So that's a brand new approach that the PCI-DSS has got in virtual projects, which, as you rightly say, I think that's going to be quite fascinating when we come across some of those.
So there's actually even a whole lot I think there was a day we were discussing on one of the clients using a hash mechanism to, you know, to encrypt their data. And, you know, you had your concerns on the sorted hash. So the version 4, you know, have gone beyond that. So you actually need to have a key encrypting hash, you know, to be able to encrypt your data. So it's not using just hash mechanism alone is no longer accepted. The hash they're going to use, you know, should be a cryptographic hash. You know?
Yeah. And if you've got your own software that's doing that, then, you know, that needs to be changed. That needs to have been changed.
Last year, really.
You know, it needs to be on top of it, changing the payment card application code, you know, because there's quite a lot of changes in the PCI-DSS version 4 that's going to require recoding.
Yeah, it is. And then even access to the CDE, all access to the CDE have to be multi-factor authenticated. Yeah. All access, so no longer those days that it's just a remote access. So,
So now it's all.
There's a whole lot of change which will require costs. So,
And planning and engineering. I mean, MFA itself is fairly straightforward because there's third-party tools that do that. But you're right. You need a migration plan so that you can kind of knock down these additional requirements bit by bit. Tristan, you're very – I mean, I'm sorry that we're ignoring you. I mean, we're interested in anything you want to ask or have to say on the matter, as well, along with anybody else here.
As kind of like a data practitioner, so looking from a data protection perspective, what I can respect and appreciate with PCI-DSS is the requirement to demonstrate. And we spoke about this, I think, a couple of weeks ago, last time I was on the podcast, Phil, about how should GDPR, you know, require you to demonstrate, and maybe not to the degree that PCI does it, but actually I think it does emphasize that. You know, I think there does need to be more requirement to demonstrate compliance, not just by data protection, but in general.
Yeah, I mean, there is, you know, obviously the accountability principle, security to be one of those principles. But there's no reporting.
Yeah.
Again, it would be, you know, this is my rose-tinted view of life. It would be great if there was a legal obligation to undertake, and it might be stratified, you know, if you're like the PCI-DSS, if you're level 4 processor, you don't have to, or control, you don't have to. And if you're level 1, high risk, lots of data, then you have to maybe submit yourself to an external audit and submit a structured report that looking at certain areas. I mean, I think that would be great, but I mean, it's never going to happen in the GDPR. It's too broad. It's not just cardholder data. It's every aspect of the data processing.
But for an organization that have that has implemented a PCI-DSS, it will actually give them, you know, an edge to be compliant to GDPR. You know, I'm looking at it from the ISO 27701 perspective. Anyway, during one of my consulting, we've implemented a PCI-DSS for them, and they're also going through the ISO 27. Okay, ISO 27701 is a privacy information management system, which actually have a kind of alignment to GDPR. Yeah. So most of the controls that have been implemented on PCI-DSS was actually utilized, you know, for the privacy information management system implementation. So.
Yeah, it gives you an edge because you've got some kind of systems and processes and disciplines and procedures. Yeah. You have to have those mandatory within the PCI-DSS. GDPR says where necessary, doesn't it? But when's it not necessary to have policies and procedures? Have you done much work, Kenny, on 27701? Because I've not actually personally done anything on the 701.
Yes, I have. I've implemented it for some organization in my country. All right, so. they were not doing GDPR, of course, it's African. So they actually relies on the train 7701. It's actually an international, you know, standard which is recognized across borders. So for most of them that, you know, that processing personal data of other countries, mm-hmm. with such a certificate, you know, it can give them an edge to go ahead with the processing.
Yeah. I don't know how popular 27701 is, but I mean, I think, and it doesn't stand alone, does it? It can only live. I mean, you could adopt the principles of it, but it has to be kind of an extension of 27001.
Yes, it's an addendum to 27001. An addendum. You cannot implement 27701 alone without having ISO 27001 in place already. ISO 27001 is for information security management system. It has the controls.
One of the keys, I remember standing up at an event talking about PCDSS and you know, somebody shouted out, heckled me, saying it's not a silver bullet. But I mean, it isn't a silver bullet. I mean, these standards aren't a silver bullet, are they? They're still getting, you know, people who are compliant, like Marriott hotels, for instance, allegedly compliant with the PCDSS, still getting hacked. So, you know, it's progress, but not, it's not an absolute guarantee, is it?
Yeah, it's not. It's not. The framework is actually very good. You know, it will help to build your security, you know, architecture and all. But it's not a silver bullet. There's always a zero-day vulnerabilities, you know.
Yeah, and you know, we probably touched on this a minute ago. But what can we, you know, learn from the PCIDSS or these other standards and applying to the context of the GDPR? You know, you're very familiar, Tris, with the GDPR and security is quite woolly. It talks about requiring a risk, you know, based approach and confidentiality and integrity, et cetera, et cetera. Pseudonymization it suggests or talks about, and it talks about things, doesn't it? But it doesn't say you've got to do. It says, you know.
Yeah.
I think it comes down to, like, I think you can say this across nearly all frameworks, but there is a level of interpretation. And I think how it's interpreted will really kind of define the risks that are kind of involved. If you have a very much if you adopt the frameworks as is and really kind of follow the rule of it, I think you'll find that your risk will be reduced quite significant. But it's when you, I think, you try to start to cut corners. Again, you can say this with GDPR, you can say this with ISO, PIMS, you can say that with PCI, even NIST. There, all these frameworks, there are problems. And I think a lot of that comes down to, when I say user error, I think it's more like when, how organizations adopt that and implement that into their own kind of structures.
Yeah, it often is how things are implemented, isn't it? You're quite familiar with the GDPR as well as all these cyber standards, aren't you, Kenna? You're a very bright person. So what kind of, in the context of security and GDPR, it's a debate we have a lot. And mentioned a couple of weeks ago here that the CNIL, the French regulator, has produced a really good security framework, about 18 different points. I think that's very good. And we've mentioned that the other week and circulated it around. What's your thoughts, Kenny, on, you know, what security in the GDPR, what can we learn from these standards? What should we cherry pick out of them?
Okay. If I'm going to speak, first and foremost, the main objective for security, information security, or the security in GDPR, you'll be looking at addressing the risk in the confidentiality, integrity, and availability, right? So most of the controls, even in PCI DSS ISO 27001, the controls are there to address the risk in the confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So when you look at GDPR, which is a regulation, you know, for protecting of personal data, right? So you have to check how is the data being protected, how is it being transmitted, you know, the integrity, who has access to this, you know, to these data. So looking at it from that point of view, the CIA, you'll be able to say that there are so many controls in the PCI DSS, so many controls from ISO 27001 that GDPR could actually key in, you know, to address its risk. Yes, most GDPR could actually key in, you know, to address its risk. Yes, most ISOs are risk-based, yeah, because you will look at your risk and also put up the controls to address them, which I believe also is also for GDPR. If you store personal data, you're accountable for the protection of this personal data. So you have to actually have to check the controls or the measures to protect this personal data. So you can adopt different framework, which there are a lot of, like PCI. The PCI is a lot, but depending on this or your scope and the kind of data that you hold, you can actually go for ISO 27001, which is the baseline for information security.
Yeah, and how much, Tristan? I think how to what extent does a DPO need to be across this? You know, are we relying on security teams to make sure that the standard is met, or are we expected to do you think to be, you know, quite expert on security and cybersecurity?
I think that's a really good question, and I think if you were wanting like a the best outcome, I think the answer is yes, but that's not practical. And I think it comes down to, depending on the kind of the organization and the kind of size and scope, but I actually believe that DPOs should have that very effective relation with, you know, cyber team, IT, legal, procurement, HR, because the way that I kind of like differentiate between everything is data protection is personal data. So that's going to be in everything. And it's very hard to actually remove scope with data protection. Whereas cyber, you can, and with PCI, you can't, it becomes more difficult again, depending on how much you offboard it. So I think, like I said, in a perfect world, yes, I think they should be able to know not just about cyber, but information governance and data management as an overarching thing. But I think in a practical world, probably not so much, but they're going to have, you know, regular meetings and great relations with these different departments that are going to be managing these areas.
Yeah. I think we've probably run out of time, actually. So I wondered if you've got any sage words of advice, Kenny, just to everybody that's listening. You know, I'm not sure if we've talked in sufficient depth about, you know, anything specific about the PCI-DSS or 27001 that you wanted to hear about. So if you've got questions, then fire them through. We can have sessions. We love, you know, having sessions about, you know, whatever you want us to talk about. But Kenny, have you got any kind of words of advice or final closing thoughts before we shut the session?
I think I'll just say that, for this digital world that we are in now, this is actually outside from, though it's still part of the security, the password is no longer enough. The username and password is no longer enough to access your web platforms. I think for everyone, you should try as much as they can to enable the multi-factor authentication, because the major hacks these days, you know, is on people. Username and password is out there. The other day, I was just checking. There was a site I was just checking, and I could see a whole lot of default username and password out there, weak username and password out there of people, and they actually put the link on how to access this. You know, like if you go to dark web, there's always there. So password is no longer enough. It's not secure at all. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And I noticed a company called FreeCycle, kind of a recycling business. They had a big hack this week, 7 million users. In fact, it was in May, I think. But their advice is, if you've got the same credentials you've used on our site, you know, that you're using on other sites, you need to change them, because that combination of username and password has been compromised. And that's what you're saying, Kelly, isn't it?
Yes. I actually even saw from that side, they're using MD5, and MD5 encryption is not considered as a weak encryption. So I'm wondering why they're using it anyways. But password is no longer enough authentication, you know, to actually use to access any platform at all. Yeah. I think even Google too have adopted the two-factor authentication. So
yeah. Tris, anything finally to say? Or
I don't think so. It's been really interesting. I like cybersecurity and PCI, so it's been very interesting for me. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
It's been a blast.
Well, I hope that was an interesting chat on the PCI-DSS and cybersecurity and GDPR and data protection, whatever else we talked about in general. We're back next week with the GDPR radio session. So that's really kind of news, opinions, blogs, views, hopefully, you know, interaction and chat. I'm not sure who's with us next week on that, but that'll be here same time next week. And then I don't know what the anything to highlight, Miles, on the upcoming things. I think we've got some interviews with other people lined up, haven't we? And we've got some other interesting topics to pick up. I think you said you couldn't speak on this because you're in a noisy environment.
Please excuse the background noise. But we've got GDPR Radio coming up next week, as always, and then we've got a lady from Communisys, Michelle, joining us the week after to show us how she sort of gets buy-in from senior board members and how sort of working with senior board members and people at a sort of C-suite level in regards to data protection can sort of filter throughout your organization. So how to sort of get buy-in from senior partners and so on and so forth. So that should be a really good one.
I think that'd be a really useful one. Yeah. Good. Well, without further ado, thank you, Kenny. Sorry to drag you away from your assessments and things, but much appreciate
your
time. Thank you,
Phil. Thank you, Christian.
Thank you, Tris. No, and thank you, everybody else, for joining. And hopefully, we'll see you next week, if not before.